Richie Neal, of course, I make no secret of the fact that I love all my children, all of the congressmen who I talk to, and there are many of them on the congressional corner, but you're my favorite. And that may be because you're also my congressman, but you have a clarity, a voice, which is really extraordinary, and you don't pretend about anything. Let me ask you about the thing I get more mail about from the Bernieites than anything else, the superdelegates. It's almost, the mail is basically saying it's a corrupted system, the superdelegates have fixed the game, and, you know, I answer it best as I can. What about you?
Well, I think that it's supposed to be for the purpose of checking emotion. And I think that the old party conventions at one time, as you know, all the way back to Lincoln and others,
sure,
it was about electability.
Right.
And I think that we went through a disastrous campaign cycle in 1968, which brought about the McGovern-Fraser guidelines, which opened the conventions up. And the idea was for what was noted as to be called a more participatory democracy, in which we, in 1972, won one state. And part of that was, even though I was a strong adherent and friend of George McGovern and actually chaired his campaign in Western Massachusetts at the age of, I think, 22 or 23,
wow,
It was a disaster for us at the presidential level. So then by the time we got to 76, the idea was that you had to bring back more of the people that gave meaning to the system in between elections. And that's the party apparatus. The parties have a way of winnowing out, I think, far left or far right thought. And there is a greater concentration that even people that might hold those views have about, well, we need to get somebody who we can elect. And then by the time that Reagan beat Carter, and then Reagan beat Mondale, we were back to the idea, and not to miss the fact that I think Reagan won 92 states in two election cycles, we were back to the idea that perhaps more of the party elders ought to participate in the nominating process.
Yeah, I remember very well when Teddy Kennedy couldn't attend the convention, I believe, that famous McGovern convention, because, you know, he was an elected senator, but not a delegate.
That's exactly right. And I remember that you could also make the argument that in the case of Ted Kennedy, where I was a delegate for him in 1980, that one of the problems we had a late series of successful primaries in California, New Jersey, New York, and a couple of more, where then we made the argument at the convention that what had begun at the beginning of the campaign, where Carter had won New Hampshire and Carter had won Illinois, and he was doing very well, that in the late stages of the campaign, we did very well. So we said at that point that in regard to that whole notion of emotion, that obviously we're doing better. So it means that we've turned the corner, only to discover that the Carter people at the convention had no interest, nor did they have any intention of opening up those rules. The rules were the rules.
Interesting. Let me go back to Trump and Hillary. You're a brilliant man. I want to ask you this. What would the strategy be that you would adopt if you were Hillary? He's going to give her a dirty name or something. We know that from Lying Ted and Little Marco, and it's worked up to now. What should she do? Should she ignore it, or should she give him a name of her own?
I think she should ignore it. And at the same time, you have surrogates.
Right.
That they can handle that part of the argument. But I also think that one of the things that she needs to do is to resist the idea of getting down into the mud and instead continue to talk about substantive issues. And I think that she should not miss the point that on the campaign trail, that Bill Clinton can be very helpful, and that, again, the mainstream of the Democratic Party, is they are not about to fall in line for Donald Trump, I can tell you that. And I think that for her to continue to express substantive positions, but you're going to find during the debates, as we did the last time around, and whether one was for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, I didn't meet anybody who didn't think she performed superbly in those debates with the Democratic primary voters at that time. And through the whole field, she held her own. The problem was that she prepared that campaign 8 years ago for November, and President Obama prepared for Iowa. And I think that quickly he became a very substantive candidate, and I thought it was very hard for her to play catch-up at that stage. But I don't know anybody who thinks that she doesn't know the answers to the questions.
There are people who are blaming her for Bill Clinton's dalliances. It seems outrageous to me, but blaming her, you know, you can't keep your man and all that.
That's preposterous.
Well, it is preposterous, but does it work?
Well, I don't think so, and I think that the worst thing that can do is to get into an argument about that with Donald Trump. I don't think it's worth it. And interestingly enough, I don't think that the media ought to embrace the entertainment value of the political season. They ought to embrace the substantive importance
of the election season. Let me argue with you. Ort schmort. That's just the way it is. You know, that's the way this thing is unfolding. You know, we used to talk about state politics in Massachusetts or New York, and, you know, it's hard to get a phone to ring or an email to come in. You mentioned the T word, and somebody wrote me today and said, what's the T word you keep talking about? I said, it rhymes with rump. But you mentioned the D word, and every phone lights up. Talk about entertainment. That's a reality.
Well, I also think that we should fret about it. I mean, I think that as we look at many of the challenges that America faces internationally and domestically, that substance still counts. And I think that reading about the issue, studying the issue, and being the smartest person in the room ought not to be a handicap.
Well, you know that, and I know that. It's just that how do you get there? In other words, you teach college. I've taught college. You give these talks to me and with us here, and it makes great sense. But how do you do it?
Well, I tell my students day in and day out, getting it right is more important than getting it first, and also to point out something else that I think is critical. When you meet the people that run these campaigns, they're pretty smart. And when you look at the people that Trump has recruited in the last month or so, that's what we need to be concerned about, not the people that he had at the beginning. And on the Clinton side, when you look at a guy like John Podesta, you quickly come to the conclusion that you've got the best. And I think that, you know, for Barack Obama, when you look back at it, David Axelrod.
Yeah.
These are individuals that are not only smart and capable, but they're visionary. And I think that to those students, I tell them all the time, still doesn't hurt you every day to read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or the Washington Post. Those reporters, and I would cite Dan Balls as an example. I would cite some of the others who are out there on the campaign trail. They're on the bus. They're on the plane. They're on the train. They're in the trenches. They know what's going on in this campaign. And I will tell you, they deal with smart people.
Let's talk a little bit about one substantive problem I want to get to, and that's the opioid crisis. I think everybody understands this one snuck up on us and really is a horrific problem in the United States. Could I ask you a question, basically, intuitively, why do you think it's such a problem? In other words, what happened?
Well, I think that there was an overprescription craze that took place, and I don't say that in a malicious way, but I think that treating pain became an issue that was immediate, and I think that the opiates were over-prescribed, and I also think that there were changes and fluctuations in the price of heroin as a reaction, and certainly selling heroin on the streets of Hartford, Springfield, or other places for $3 a bag certainly had implications, and I think that the consistency of this, and I've been very much involved in this issue.
I know you have.
Is that you can see people who never in a million years thought that they would be addicted becoming addicted. And one of the things that I still do and have done throughout a career, I very carefully pour through the obituary pages. And I think more and more you're seeing parents and others of loved ones, they are willing to say that my son or my daughter or my brother, or my sister, or my mother or my father, that they fell prey and victim, and that's how they died. And I think that calling attention to heroin on Cape Cod, which was an HBO movie that I've displayed widely, we've had broad consensus here in the Congress. We did some pretty good work on it last week. We'll have to reconcile some differences. I have sponsored personally the notion that those who administered Narcan at the site, that they should not be held victim later on, if it doesn't go right,
sort of Good Samaritan law.
The Good Samaritan law. And I think that there are a series of things that we can continue to do, but not to miss the point that there are an awful lot of fine people who have found themselves trapped in addiction.
I only have a couple of seconds, Richie, but I can't help asking you this. Narcan is great, but how do you lessen demand?
Well, I mean, that's part of the issue here, and it sounds callous when we describe it as a matter of supply and demand, but it certainly is. And you know, Alan, I hear people talk about the fact that for years that Mexico had a drug problem and that Colombia had a drug problem. Demand is the problem in America.
Yep. Absolutely true. Well, Richie Neal, always fun. We come back the next time. We'll do more, okay?
Thanks, Alan.